half century ago that NASA introduced its first seven astronauts, the famous Mercury Seven. Yesterday, the head of NASA introduced another seven people he called space pioneers. This time, the seven were all executives at companies working to develop private spaceships for astronauts. That's because under President Obama's new budget for the space agency, it would cancel its own rocket program and rely on commercial space taxis to get crews into orbit. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
Charles Bolden is a former astronaut and the head of NASA. He spoke in front of reporters and space executives at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and said the fears swirling around NASA's future just aren't true.
We are not abandoning human spaceflight by any stretch of the imagination.
Even though NASA will retire the space shuttle this year, and President Obama's proposed new budget would kill its replacement, NASA's Constellation program. That's the new system of rockets and capsules that NASA has been designing to take astronauts first to the space station and ultimately to the moon. Instead, under the new plan, NASA would concentrate on developing technologies to venture far out into space. And to get astronauts up to the nearby station, it would just buy astronaut rides from private companies.
I've got seven companies represented right here who are telling me that they're excited about finding ways to get humans off this planet and into low Earth orbit. That's human spaceflight.
Bolden asked executives from the seven companies to line up at the front of the room.
Ladies and gentlemen, these are the faces of the new frontier.
To help boost the development of commercial space taxis, NASA has just awarded a total of $50 million in grants to five of the companies. They include the Sierra Nevada Corporation of Colorado, the Space Exploration Division of the Boeing Company in Houston, and Blue Origin from Washington State. NASA officials say it's not pie-in-the-sky dreaming to think that companies like these could someday have capsules capable of ferrying astronauts into space. NASA already has agreements with a couple of companies building unmanned spaceships to take cargo to the space station. One of them is Orbital Sciences Corporation in Virginia. David Thompson is its CEO.
We're just a little over 1 year away from the first launch of our cargo-carrying spacecraft on a new rocket that we're developing.
He says this cargo ship could be modified to carry up people.
We believe it will take about 4 years from the time the cargo-carrying spaceship has proven itself to upgrade it and to demonstrate that it is safe and reliable enough to carry astronauts.
Another company building a cargo ship for the station that could quickly turn into a human space taxi is SpaceX of California. Ken Bowersox is a former astronaut who works as vice president for astronaut safety and mission assurance at SpaceX. He says they'll have a major rocket test this spring and hope to have their first cargo flight within a year of that. After that, he says,
the goal of SpaceX has always been to eventually carry crews into low Earth orbit.
He says SpaceX and other firms are up to this challenge.
I think the odds are very, very high that we'll have more than just one of the companies in that room building a capsule that will carry crews into low Earth orbit within the next 5 years.
But some lawmakers worry about taking that gamble. So NASA officials are sure to face tough questions from Congress in the coming weeks. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
Airlines are paying extra attention these days to the weather in space. That's because thousands of commercial flights each year now take shortcuts over the North and South Poles. Those flights are vulnerable to cosmic storms caused by disturbances on the sun, events that can disable communication systems and even expose travelers to radiation. NPR's John Hamilton looks at efforts to keep planes and people safe by predicting rough weather in space.
On most days, United Airlines Flight 895 takes off from Chicago, flies over the North Pole, and lands in Hong Kong without making a stop. But on four consecutive days in January 2005, the flight had to make a detour through Anchorage, Alaska. The reason? An eruption on the surface of the sun was sending a burst of electromagnetic radiation and charged particles toward Earth. The Earth's magnetic field tends to funnel this energy toward the north and south poles. That's what causes the northern lights and similar auroras in extreme southern latitudes. The effect can be breathtaking from the ground. But Bill Murta from the U.S. government Space Weather Prediction Center says you probably don't want to watch from an airplane crossing one of the poles.
The air traffic controller could be talking to the pilot 1 minute, and really, literally within a minute or so, that signal can go from quite clear to a scratchy noise, and there's no longer any ability to communicate.
Radio interference is just one problem. GPS navigation systems may stop working entirely. And in just a few hours, people on board could be exposed to the amount of radiation in a dozen chest X-rays. Even so, Murta says, routes that cross the North and South Poles are increasingly popular. That's because they let planes take the shortest path between North America and Asia, or Argentina and New Zealand.
So you're shaving off a couple of hours of flight time, which everyone appreciates. Airlines, because it saves fuel, and the customer, because they're not on the plane as long.
Which is why the number of polar flights has gone from just a handful a decade ago to more than 7,000 last year. Most of those flights have taken place during a relatively quiet period for space weather. Murta says that's because there hasn't been much activity on the sun during the past several years.
Right now in the solar minimum, we're just turning the corner, and we'll continue to see an increase in solar activity over the next 3, 4, 5 years or so.
As we reach what's called the solar maximum. All that has got the attention of the Federal Aviation Administration. Stephen Albersheim from the FAA says the combination of more polar flights and more solar activity means air traffic controllers are increasingly likely to encounter a scenario they prefer to avoid.
You've got aircraft which are already en route, on their way over the high latitudes, and you have a solar event that was not foreseen.
Albersheim says controllers have no choice but to begin diverting those flights. Then the real problems start.
When you have a bad weather day, space weather, and an aircraft have been dispatched thinking that they can fly these high latitudes, then all of a sudden they get notification that there's got to be a diversion. Air traffic control in Anchorage has to be able to accept all those flights.
That scenario wouldn't happen if space weather forecasts were as accurate as their earthbound counterparts. But Bill Murta says they're not.
In the terrestrial weather and meteorology, we rely largely on models, and there are many different sets of models available to make forecasts, and these models are advanced and quite good. We are not there yet with the space weather models, although we are getting there.
One promising model has emerged in just the past couple of weeks. It's being developed by researchers at the Space Weather Prediction Center, which is part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Alicia Reinert and her colleagues showed they could predict solar flares 2 or 3 days ahead of time. The trick was to track changes in the swirls of plasma beneath active areas on the surface of the sun.
In Earth terms, it's most like a smoke ring.
Reinert says the ring twists in a distinctive way before producing a flare.
We can pick up about 30-35% to half, depending on how big the flares are, so we still miss a lot of them.
But Reinert says even a model that's right only half the time could protect a lot of planes and the people on them from bad space weather. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Some climate change skeptics explain their doubts by citing temperature trends. They point out that global temperatures have plateaued over the past 10 years. Well, now a new study has found at least a partial explanation why. And as NPR's Richard Harris reports, the answer is above our heads.
Global warming has not stopped. The last decade is the warmest since temperature record-keeping began, and 2009 was one of the warmest years ever recorded. But if you look over the course of the last decade, there is no strong warming trend in that time period. Susan Solomon at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Colorado says that leads to an obvious question.
People very reasonably have asked me, you know, why is it that in the last decade it just doesn't look like it's gotten that much warmer, even though CO2 has continued to increase and, in fact, has increased quite fast?
The short answer is there's lots of natural variability in the climate. Tropical ocean patterns called El Niños and La Niñas can have strong warming or cooling effects. The sun even gets slightly brighter or dimmer. And now Solomon pinpoints another cause in a new study. It has to do with vapor way up high in the stratosphere.
There have been some surprising changes in stratospheric water vapor that have really packed a wallop as far as surface climate goes.
It turns out, starting in the year 2000, a narrow layer of the stratosphere dried out quite rapidly, and water in the atmosphere traps heat, like glass in a greenhouse, so less stratospheric water means less warming.
It's amazing that the stratosphere, which is so far removed from the surface, can exert such a big effect.
In fact, Solomon calculates that the loss of water in the stratosphere has offset about a quarter of the warming that would otherwise have occurred.
I hasten to say it is not the whole answer, probably, to the reason why there has been so little obvious warming in the last decade, but I think it's probably part of it.
Solomon figures that the stratosphere is dry because there have been fewer towering thunderstorms in the tropics to push water up there. But Andrew Dessler at Texas A&M University says this is almost certainly a temporary state of affairs.
This can't keep cooling or offsetting carbon dioxide forever.
Not forever, since first, the stratosphere can only get so dry, and second, the weather patterns that cause the stratosphere to dry out are bound to change. So this is clearly part of a shorter-term variation in the climate. Dessler compares it to the gyrations of the stock market.
You've got sort of day-to-day or month-to-month ups and downs, but there's this long-term trend, whether it's going up and down, and that's really what you care about in the stock market and in the climate.
Still, it's very useful to identify the factors that drive the short-term ups and downs. That way you aren't fooled into thinking that a temporary change is actually part of a long-term trend.
You can often be confused with what looks like a trend that may go on for a long time, but turns out not to be a trend. I mean, the housing market, that's the problem in a nutshell. People saw this going up, they thought it's going on forever, but it wasn't.
The long-term trend of climate change is obvious. The most recent decade was hotter than the 1990s, the 1990s were hotter than the 1980s, and so on. And Susan Solomon says the science behind that long-term trend is well understood, and water in the stratosphere is not driving it.
But it's really helpful and fascinating, I think, to better understand the ups and downs that may happen from one year to another, from one decade to another. There's a lot more that we need to understand there.
Her new research, published online in Science Magazine, is a piece of that puzzle. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Caves are some of the last places on the planet left to explore. Though caving is relatively safe, if something goes wrong deep inside the earth, a rescue can take days, in part because cell phones and walkie-talkies don't work underground. But now a remarkable teenager in New Mexico has invented a device that may significantly speed the rescue process by allowing cavers to text from deep underground. As Brad Horn reports from Carlsbad, New Mexico, the young man's invention may have other applications as well.
The kid is smart. So smart, he says stuff like this.
I rewrote my receive program and added a noise rejection system that can throw out Navy beacon pulses that get intermixed with my signal, and so that way...
16-year-old Alexander Kendrick won the 2009 International Science Fair for inventing this cave texting device. The award got the teen from Los Alamos, New Mexico, a new computer, a trip to Switzerland, and $12,000 in checks. I wanted to find out why this thing was such a big deal. And the next thing I knew, I was hanging from a rope in the bowels of the earth and groaning under my breath.
God help me.
I was with a team of cavers in Carlsbad Caverns National Park in New Mexico, heading 1,000 feet underground to test Kendrick's invention, which is something like a computer attached to a ham radio. It transmits data using low-frequency radio waves that can penetrate rock more easily than high-frequency transmissions like those in FM broadcasts. If this test succeeded, it would be the deepest known underground digital communication ever to take place in the United States. And why would anyone want to text from nearly 1,000 feet underground? Here's why. In a 1991 New Mexico cave rescue, it took 170 people 4 days to save a woman with a broken leg. The rescue team had to lay miles of telephone line in order to stay in touch with the surface. If they'd had Alex's radio, the rescue time may have been cut in half. That could make the difference between life or death. The other reason this thing is a pretty big deal?
Come and I'll show you the lab.
Science. This is Diana Northup, a microbiologist at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque.
There are some nasty chemicals here in the lab, so don't touch stuff.
Her research lab is full of cave bacteria in petri dishes. Northup tells me that scientists find microorganisms in these deep caves that might have the potential to kill superbugs.
Microorganisms that live in such a low-nutrient environment actually put out antibiotics. They produce them.
But scientists think one of the biggest threats to this emerging source of antibiotics is actually the scientists themselves. People contaminate the sensitive cave environment just by being there. In fact, researchers believe the more they visit the cave, the less likely they are to find antibiotics there. Northrop thinks that by connecting data recorders to Alex's radio, scientists could remotely transmit information about the cave environment.
So a cave radio that allows you to beam data to the surface rather than visiting it in person can be extremely valuable. It could save the cave.
Back in the cave, we've arrived at the test spot, exactly 946 feet underground. The radio is being set up on the edge of a big pool of blue-green water pocked with stalagmite islands. It was 68 degrees, but incredibly humid. Alex and the team pulled pieces of white PVC tubing from their backpacks and assembled the radio's antenna, which looks like a 6-foot-wide tic-tac-toe frame with wire wrapped around it. His dad, Brian, was about to hike to an identical unit sitting directly above us on the surface.
So now we have 2 hours to get in place.
1 hour and 59 minutes, actually.
Are you getting nervous?
No.
You're making me nervous.
They synchronized their watches, and Brian and another caver climbed the steep, dusty slope above us. And then we waited. 2 hours later, after calibrating the devices, Alex typed the word happy on a rubber keyboard and pushed send. Up above on the surface, his father stared at a small screen, hoping to see the word.
4, 3, 2, 1, here it comes, let's hope. Any second now, he should send us something, let's hope. So we missed the H, but we got appy. That's excellent, we got it. That's digital data coming through at 950 feet, roughly.
Now, Alex has to fine-tune the radio to make it smaller and tougher and easier for rescue crews to get down into caves. That'll have to wait, though, because he's busy working on his 2010 science fair project, a device that finds underground rivers by measuring their electromagnetic currents. I don't know what problem he'll solve next, but I hear there's this thing called global warming. For NPR News, I'm Brad Horn.
Some scientists say we are natural-born runners, that our bodies evolved to run. Now, the leading proponent of the so-called human runner school concludes that we do it more efficiently without shoes. NPR's Christopher Joyce has this story on barefoot running.
Anthropologist Dan Lieberman says human ancestors needed to run well, away from big animals and after small, tasty ones, for example. He based that view on fossil bones. Lately, though, he's been studying runners, living ones. It started at a lecture he gave before the Boston Marathon. A barefoot runner, someone who runs long distances without shoes, peppered the professor with questions he couldn't answer. So Lieberman took him to his lab at Harvard University. He had him run over a flat metal plate that measures the collisional force of a footfall. Lieberman says runners generate a lot of collisional force.
Most runners, when they land and they heel strike, they land on their heel, they generate this sudden impulse, this sharp spike of force. So it's like somebody hitting you on the heel with a hammer about 1.5 to 3 times your body weight.
Lieberman was surprised by the extremely low force readings made by the barefoot runner.
He ran across the force plate and he didn't have it. And I thought, gee, that's really amazing. And it kind of makes sense because that spike of force hurts. And I wonder if other barefoot runners do that.
So Lieberman tested several groups of runners, Kenyans who'd been walking and running barefoot all their lives, and Americans who grew up walking and running in shoes, and some who switched from shoes to running barefoot. He found that runners in shoes usually land heel first. Barefoot runners land farther forward, either on the ball of their foot or somewhere in the middle of the foot. And then the heel comes down. That spreads the impact force across the foot, ankle, and lower leg muscles. There's less sudden vertical force shooting up the leg that way. Also, people who switched from shoes to barefoot running eventually, without prompting, adopted the barefoot style. Lieberman, who runs marathons himself, says the reason is simple.
It's pain of avoidance. It's very easy to do, and your body naturally tells you what to do.
Running shoes dampen the shock of a heel-first landing. So, Lieberman says, that's probably why shoed people run that way. But is that the most efficient way to run? Lieberman thinks not.
Turns out that the way in which barefoot runners run seems to store up more energy.
To understand how that works, I talked with anthropologist Brian Richmond at George Washington University. He points out that the human foot has an arch with ligaments inside that stretch and contract with every footfall.
It allows the arch of the foot and the calf muscles to act as a better spring and to store up energy and then give it back in the beginning of the next step.
Think of a compressed mattress spring pushed down and then released. Richmond agrees with Lieberman that the front-first landing of barefoot running probably capitalizes on that spring mechanism more than heel-first landing. It gets more spring out of the spring. Richmond, in fact, has discovered fossilized footprints dating back 1.5 million years. Those human ancestors who left them had an arch. They were walking when they left the prints, but Richmond now suspects that when they ran, they landed front first.
It looks like this is how our ancestors have been running for 1 million years or more. It's only been the last 10,000 years that we've had any kind of shoes, really.
Lieberman published his findings in the journal Nature. He received research funding from a company that makes minimal shoes, which mimic barefoot conditions. He adds that he received no personal income from the company. He also says he's not taking sides over which style of running is better or safer.
I think we have to be really careful about what we do and we don't know. We have not done any injury studies, and this is not an injury study.
That, he says, is next. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Run, 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 take a drag or two. Run, 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 gyms are dead for you. Hey, what you do? Margarita Passion, I had to get her fixed. She wasn't well, she was getting sick. Went to sell her soul, she wasn't high, didn't know. Think she could buy it, she would run, 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 take a drag or two. Run, 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 gypsy death in you. Tell you what you do.